The work of this church in the world is realized through the generous financial support of all who call this place home. Along with the gifts and time and talent, ours is a shared ministry. You have a role to play here. Church membership is open to all. For more information, go to uusf.org.
January's theme has been story. All month, we've been looking at different facets of story, the stories we tell about ourselves and to reflect on those, the stories and texts that we write and ground ourselves in collectively. Last week, we looked at Jonathan Egg's biography of Martin Luther King Jr. and what his story told through the author's eyes offered us at this moment. And today, we look at one story. An old one. Joseph Campbell, the great student of stories, thought mythical stories held great power. They were, he said, quote, more important and true than history. Myths and story got at something deeper than facts, he thought. They could call us into our own lives in more compelling ways. Story shapes us, and we shape story. And religion and religious texts are full of stories. Taken as fact, though, they lose something. Taken as metaphor, taken as an invitation to wander with them, I think we find the power to unlock their magic. And one of the things about being part of a religious tradition is the invitation to visit and revisit the same stories as they reveal themselves over time in nuance, as we are in a different place in our own lives when we meet them. There is no been there, done that about any good story or myth. So I'd like to approach today's story in that vein, and in doing so, maybe round out this month of dancing with the notion of story, though we will always be about telling stories in this place. In the Bible, there are four what are called Gospels. Each of the Gospels has a different perspective on the life and ministry of Jesus, and each is speaking to a different audience. They overlap a great deal in their content, but this particular story is only told in the Gospel according to John. And it comes very near to the beginning of that story, which is odd because it's a story that comes somewhat late in the life of Jesus. But the Gospel of John begins, as you may recall these words, with the famous, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God." To read John's Gospel is to think that Jesus came down fully formed, the moment when truth met flesh and spirit was incarnate. No diapers, minimal human mess. John's gospel begins really with John the Baptist, who, according to this gospel, is sent by God to identify who is this Word made flesh to the world. And John is baptizing people, a kind of second birth into a new life. And he's doing this as the way that's been revealed to him to see in that moment who and where this person is. And it's only in the first chapter of this gospel that John baptizes a man he's never met before and sees the dove or spirit descend on this man and not leave him. And John has found his Messiah. The man identified to read the story seems somewhat nonplussed by it all, even as others who hear of it start to follow him. Two disciples at the beginning and shortly two more, all so far largely trusting in the word of this wild-eyed man, John the Baptist, who is often shown in tattered shards of clothing and his hair dangerously and permanently unkept. Right? The reality is, however, that we and those who likely encountered this gospel actually knew some of the other stories about Jesus's earlier life, the ones that were circulating in the other versions of the gospel or oral tradition. They read this gospel, but they probably knew the story of this baby born on a miraculous night, of a boy who lives largely unnoticed and anonymously, though his mother and father have been made known to them very clearly who they have in their lives and have given life to. They know, I'm sure, the story of the boy who gets lost in Jerusalem and separated from his family, and when they find him, he's in the temple, the great temple, instructing the rabbis. But otherwise, there isn't much drama about this young man's life that we know of. Even in John, this man stumbles into a baptism, it seems, and wanders, gathering disciples despite himself, though he is saying and doing very little at this point to garner attention for himself. And then he and his mother are invited to a wedding, and maybe it's like in India where if you're invited to a wedding, anyone in your household is invited because the disciples are also invited. And this is our story, this wedding. And I suppose it's going the way most weddings go. There's no mention of the ceremony or the first dance. We skip right to the moment in the reception where the tension arises. The family has run out of wine. I think we can all imagine the awkwardness of this moment. It's not great to run out of anything in the middle of a wedding. However, it is likely in this part of the world, influenced as it is, was and is, by ancient customs of desert hospitality, where mutual survival depends on the care of the stranger, where the guest is God. In this world where the Bedouin keep the dulla on the fire at all time in their tents, so when a stranger comes, they can be given coffee and then welcomed for 3 nights, fed and cared for and protected, and you are not allowed to ask their name. Such is the code of hospitality. In this world where stories circulate about the miracles that come to those who welcome the stranger, and where curses fall upon those who are not hospitable, here, perhaps, not having enough wine at the wedding is analogous to the unimaginable shame upon your house that running out of rice is at an Indian wedding. Something you will never recover from. Maybe. It seems serious enough for Mary to try and do what she can. Or maybe Mary just likes a good party and this interruption of the fun is sort of annoying for her, so she wants to move on to the celebrations. We don't know. But we do know that this mother, who has kept her son's gifts under wraps for decades by now, turns to him and asks him to fix the problem, which is not to say go to the corner store and charge 2 cases and have them delivered as soon as possible. No, she's asking a little of that Jesus magic that she either suspects or has seen play out in their intimate life as a family. In the story, Jesus resists, Can we imagine how he might feel? Imagine you have a sense of your tremendous gifts, ones that will upend the world when you unleash them, ones that everyone will notice. And you already have four people following you who have figured out who you are, but still you try maybe to hide it. You ride out a normal life as long as you can. And you know, once the curtain is pulled back, what will happen to you, all of it? I mean, how much of God's knowledge do you put on with God's power? At the very least, maybe like Daniel with his single room and a friend down the hall and a light schedule, being asked to do this thing you know is not a simple ask. Whether you know just how life-changing it is in the moment or not, you know enough, don't you? So Jesus asks why she is telling him to do this, how this isn't his time. But whatever he thinks in that moment, however he hesitates, that Jesus in this gospel then calls over the servants and asks for some of those amphoras they hold the water in for purification rituals, and he has them fill them to the brim, and when they're done, to take it into the steward at the wedding. And the wedding goes on, and a whole lot begins to unfold. So much happens in this moment that isn't about the wine, and it isn't about the wedding. Right? At this moment and forever after, four disciples have proof attached to the person they suspected they have found, and now it's absolutely certain. Now they know that John baptizing at the river was right. And also, let's be clear, everyone at the wedding knows, the servants, the steward who served the wine, the couple and their family who were panicked. Everyone will be talking in a white hot Cana minute about who this person really is. Did you suspect? I mean, he always seemed, you know, well, his skin was always perfectly clear, so I suppose we should have guessed. And news will spread in a world where there isn't much probably super exciting news. Don't you think news will spread? And so the word is out about the word made flesh. And after this moment, it actually is true that Jesus' new life begins and that he leans into it. Irretrievably launched, despite his hesitation, he leaves the wedding, and his next stop is the temple in Jerusalem where the dubiously religious rabbi who was placed there by the Roman government, who has turned over the inner courtyard for the sale of average market goods and so desecrated that place, where Jesus arrives and seeing this is so enraged that he throws a temper tantrum and throws over the tables. There is no quiet entry. He isn't going quietly into this new calling. He's there to save the world from itself, and once launched, he's soon teaching, and he's healing, and he's raising the dead, and he's feeding a crowd of 5,000, and he's preaching about a power higher than Rome, and you and I know how the story can begin to feel when we read it, like there is this frighteningly magnetic pull toward the end, the horrific end. In Jonathan Egg's biography of King, he quotes James Farmer, an activist in the civil rights movement, who says, "Evil societies always destroy their conscience." It's true. Does Jesus know this too? One suspects he does. But once launched, there is this sense he has to do what he's there to do and let the chips fall where they may. We kind of know some of that in life, don't we? You marry or enter a committed partnership and you see how love is carried through the chapters of life together, full of risk and beauty, nothing you could predict. You decide on a career and you throw yourself into it, not knowing how the industry will change or what your boss will ask you to do or what this life will ask you to resist doing, because it feels like where you're meant to bring your gifts to bear. You agree to go on any adventure and to leave ordinary things behind, that second stage in the hero's journey, as Joseph Campbell outlines it. And the rest? The rest is the story's own unfolding that you are called to throw yourself into. I have been haunted by this story since I first read it years ago, and full of wondering about it. Why did Mary ask what she did? Did she kick herself when she realized what she had set in motion? Or were they both somehow clear that it was going to happen anyway? Could they feel the tension building of his need to step out into what they knew his destiny was going to be about? And so why not launch it as a banquet? What an incredible metaphor for what he wanted to bring to life in the world. Once launched this way, it strikes me again and again, he could really have turned back, right? I mean, we can turn back from these moments, just run and hide. But also, the more I live, the more I realize when we do take these steps, how often something inside us shifts, and this choice has somehow linked us to some destiny, some piece of it, and as hard as it may be, we are aligned with it. And so choice, it's kind of a funny word to use at that point. Turning back would feel like not being who we are and are called to be. Have you had these crossroads moments? Anything come into mind for folks? Are you at one right now, maybe? See some heads. And here's the scary question for me and us. Will we all face one in the years ahead in all that's coming? And how do we prepare? Daniel, thanks for sharing about one of your moments. I think you captured beautifully how so often we can feel in the moment like it's part stumble and part luck. How sometimes it comes with like an invitation, like the wedding in Cana, by someone who sees something in that moment that we don't see, and they have a sense that we're linked to this piece of life's unfolding. I think it was you who told me, Meg, that Jeremy Taylor, who is a well-known personage in the Bay Area, who was famous for his dream groups and helping people in that piece of the way the world gives us messages. I've thought of this again and again, how you told me, I hope I'm right, because otherwise you have no power to contradict me right now, that we can't actually interpret our own dreams, that we need other people listening to our dreams to help us. They see what our dreams mean. And I wonder how much that might be true of our own lives unfolding sometimes, that people see things that actually we can't. We're too close to ourselves. And I think back to the fact that I married my husband, but if you track it back, I married him because we were both at a wedding, and at the end, he was going around and asking people, with no interest in me at the time, asking people if they wanted to go to an after party, and I was declining, and my father said, "Oh, Reverend, have a good time once in a while." And I was so embarrassed. And it was kind of true that I was becoming a dud, and so I went. and everything changed. For me, more often than not, actually, big crossroad moments in my life that feel right, actually, had someone else as a midwife in them. And it's a great challenge to our notion, again, of the self-made person, our autonomous myth. There is so much in this story for us to sit with and to reflect on. Because I think if we have heroes' journeys somewhere in our lives, it will by definition mean turning at some point from the ordinary and the known and the safe paths for reasons possibly seemingly accidental that we chose and assented to, of course, to upend that plan. And once on that trajectory, how often we'll feel some pull, some hook, what process theologians called this lure, that carries us forward, that feels powerful and necessary, like the urge of the plant to turn toward the sun, almost, like the force inside us that somehow knows when we're going the way that actually grows a soul, growing pains, aching and necessary and beautiful. And how these roads that we take in these moments are rarely full of just giggles and meadows of flowers. Complicated, challenging, and to be ready for them, to know them and see them for what they are as quickly as we can. Emergent thinker Adrienne Marie Brown wrote, "I want to see lots of people who are up to movement work and also writing the stories about our future. And so I have been driven back to the spiritual realm more in this period, in the sense that I don't think it's enough to have a great cause and a great set of information and a great even set of practices or a roadmap. I think that we have to attend to the aspect of humanity that thinks of ourselves as having some kind of destiny, some kind of purpose, some kind of calling for being here." This day, as we prepare, even just this Sunday for the town hall, when we're gonna hear again about the stands we will take and sign up for the issues and concerns that we will gel around leading one another through so that our moral response is visible. May our yes, yours and mine, be to the start of something powerful in us and together. May the world's deep hunger hook into our aliveness waiting to unfold, and even if it scares us, may we heed that pull, step into something that never has its perfect time. Turn water into wine, in all that that might mean for us and for this gorgeous, aching world. May the stories of old live on in us, my friends. May we make it so. Amen.
One of my most formative experiences almost didn't happen. When I was first asked to take on the role, I said no. I'm not qualified. I'm not sure I can handle it, or at least want to make the sacrifices necessary. Let me back up. My university had a long-standing student peer counseling group. A large group of student volunteers ran a 24/7 peer counseling center so that any student could call us anytime to talk about anything that was bothering them. The volunteer counselors had some training, mostly about coaching our peers to solve their own problems while feeling heard and cared for. So in my third year of undergrad, I took the course that would train me to join this group. I wasn't even sure that I wanted to join, but everyone said that the listening skills that I would learn were useful in friendships and beyond, so I figured that it couldn't hurt. Then the following term, in the spring, I decided to volunteer, mostly out of love for the positive energy and values that everyone I met from the organization had. I still saw it as a small experiment, a way to deepen the skills that I had learned, become a part of a community that I was growing to love, and help a few people. Fast forward a couple of months, I had been staffing a quiet morning time slot, so I had still never actually counseled a real person who called us, just had a series of practices with other trainees. The way that this group was structured, the core of the leadership team were four live-in counselors. They were the ones who woke up to answer the phones overnight to achieve that 24/7 service, and also took on most of the leadership of the overall group. I was friends with a former live-in and always thought that it was an admirable role, but also a miserable one. Amidst all of the exams, projects, and one's own personal drama, the live-ins had to layer in the unpredictable sleep deprivation caused by answering calls at 3 a.m., not to mention all of the leadership work. Regardless, I assumed that my ambivalent curiosity about this role was irrelevant. I was 1 year from graduation, and I still hadn't counseled a single real person in need. Then came the announcement that one of the live-ins that we had lined up for the following year needed to change his plans. They had to fill the role ASAP. I still didn't think much of this because there were about 70 active volunteers, and pretty much all of them were more qualified than me. But the next day, one of the live-ins approached me and encouraged me to apply. I told her, "You must be able to find someone better." And she basically said, "Nope." Not everyone is up for the role, and it was so late in the year that folks who might have said yes had conflicting jobs, study abroad lined up, you know, some kind of reason they couldn't do it. So I mulled it over. I had a great single room lined up for my senior year, down the hall from one of my best friends. I planned to enjoy the year sleeping well without a roommate, figuring out if I wanted to go to grad school, enjoying time with my friends, making some money as a teaching assistant, and putting my best foot forward in job interviews. It was the perfect plan. I would make the most of both the academic and social sides of my final year as an undergrad. And after about 2 days of reflection, I blew it all up. There was another kind of learning available to me, and another way of serving the campus. In my short time with that counseling center, I had grown to deeply believe in the service we provided. I knew that if I took on the role, it would become the central thing that I did my senior year, which was originally why I wanted to say no. But ultimately, it was why I said yes. I had finished my graduation requirements, except for a few perfunctory ones, so I was uniquely able to give this role my all. And it's hard for me to even think about how things would be if I hadn't said yes. I learned so much about listening to and helping people, about leading a large organization, about supporting people who are new in a role, and about handling very difficult situations. I'm also extremely proud of the work that I did and the ways in which I was able to step up to carry extra burdens. I really don't know who I would be without the luck of that role opening up, without prior leaders seeing my maturity and potential, and without my discernment that some things are worth more than a good night's sleep. Maybe I would not be a manager at work, a role that I took on a few years ago and have been thriving in. Maybe I wouldn't have cultivated as many deep friendships. And maybe I would have a more narrow and self-centered outlook on the world. Sometimes you have to blow up your best laid plans.